Welcome back to Mike and Maurice's Mind Escape. Let us help you escape your mind.
Welcome back to Mike and Maurice's Mind Escape. We have episode number 211 tonight. We're going to be doing a little bit of science news. We're going to be discussing archaeology and megalithic sites and all the recent findings and discoveries. Shout out to Sandy. I know you were asking for this for a while. And before we get started, shout out to our new Patreon members, Jonathan, Dead Inside, Mitchell, and Pete. We appreciate you, so thank you very much for that.
Beautiful.
And before we get started, if you have not already, head on over to our Patreon at patreon.com/mindescapepodcast. For just $2 a month, you'll get exclusive guest episodes and segments. I just threw up like a 45-minute long segment with Martin from The Alchemical Mind, which we just had him on last episode. It was a great conversation regarding basically like belief versus knowledge and gnosis and the difference, and then we get into metaphysics and all sorts of things, so go check that out. And head on over to indrasweb.org. This is the social media platform we created to connect open minds. So if you like hypothesizing, theorizing, speculating on all these topics, whether it's ancient sites or knowledge or metaphysics, whatever it is, the perfect place to do it. Go set up a profile. We're still working on trying to get that in the App Store. So, and what's going on, Maurice? How are you?
I'm doing well, man. Just clinging to these last days of summer. How about you?
Yeah, it's pretty warm here, I'm not going to lie.
It's warm, yeah. It's,
waiting for it to cool down a little. But
yeah, but then you'll miss it, you know. You gotta take it in the days that you have.
So today or tonight, I thought we would talk about some of the more recent discoveries. I'm pretty active on Twitter. That's where I get a lot of these articles and you know, retweeting stuff all the time. So if you don't follow us on Twitter, go check us out on there. I have the link down below, and I have a little slideshow ready for us.
Beautiful.
So, I mean, have you followed anything recent? Anything pop up in your purview that you've checked out recently?
I don't know.
I know you've been busy. So.
A lot of stuff has popped up, but it's not stuff we want to talk about, man.
Yeah, I see where you're going with that. So, yeah. But
it's good to branch out though and talk about some other stuff. Absolutely.
Yeah, and that's why we do the show. There's a reason why it's called Mind Escape. It's a little portion of time where you can kind of just get away, learn something new, have fun. So, but we appreciate everybody listening and. Yeah, so let's get started here. So there's a little backdrop there of Teotihuacan. All right, so this is the first article that popped up recently. So the Dead Sea Scrolls, secrets decoded? ? So basically this article is talking about how the Dead Sea Scrolls... most people think that they were, you know, attributed to the Essenes, which were like a mystical Jewish sect that was doing their own thing kind of in the desert. And let's see here. It says this Dr. Daniel Vainstub, he was going through like this thing. It's called the Cairo. I think it's called Geniza. I don't know how you pronounce that, but... it's this Jewish manuscript fragments, like this big collection of scripts, basically. I think there's like 400,000 of them.
Wow.
And he thinks that they contain the secrets of the Dead Sea Scrolls. So Dr. Daniel Vainstub is of Ben-Gurion University, and he published a peer-reviewed study in the Open Access Academic Journal. So it was previously thought that the Essenes had permanent settlements in the area where the Dead Sea Scrolls were found, and Dr. Vainstub hypothesizes that site was actually more likely a public place where people would travel for the passing of the covenant ceremony. The ceremony is based on Moses' instructions to the Israelites on how to proclaim God's blessings and curses on Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim. I don't know how you pronounce that. After they enter the land. So, again, they found the Dead Sea Scrolls in Qumran in these caves up in, like, those mountains. As you can see there, that's a picture of it, actually. And, again, they thought that maybe there was this, like, the Essenes were just up there doing their thing or in the area. And, I mean, this is kind of a different take. So this is saying this is more of like a pilgrimage that these people would go to this location, as opposed to them already living in that area. But I think he goes on to say that there was probably settlements in the area. However, there was like a smaller population, and then they would host all these other people coming from all these other places for this ceremony. Dr. Vane Stubb was quoted saying, "My theory is also consistent with the fact that the scrolls did not necessarily originate from Qumran, but rather were brought there to the caves from all over the country and were left in the caves over the decades. The site of Qumran, with its facilities, caves, and surfaces, accords with the evidence of annual gatherings that emerges from the scrolls. No other site is suitable for such a purpose." So, kind of interesting.
Yeah.
If you're a hardcore escapee or you've been listening to us for a long time, we did one of our earliest episodes on the Dead Sea Scrolls and the Nag Hammadi texts. So, I mean, if you're interested in that episode, I forget what episode it is, but it's one of our earlier episodes. So,
time to excavate more.
Excavate. You always got that. You always get that one wrong. I don't know why. It must be a tongue twister
wrong
for you. So yeah, that's kind of interesting, and it's a different, you know, take on that. I don't know what to.
So he's saying that people gather there instead of actually living there.
He's saying that a small population would live there, but there would be people coming from all over the country to visit there, almost like a pilgrimage for some sort of ceremony. I think he said that the ceremony is detailed in Deuteronomy. I don't know what. I'll add all the articles to all these stories too in the bottom when I'm done. So if you're interested, you can go read the articles yourself.
All right.
Okay. So this 7,200-year-old Indonesian skeleton DNA reveals Denisovan ancestry. So in 2015, the skeleton of an Indonesian woman nicknamed Bessie was found in a cave in Indonesia. Archaeologists suggest this is a look at into the earliest settlers to basically leave mainland China or Asia. Bessie belonged to the Toleans, I believe that's how you pronounce that, which was a culture of hunter-gatherers that never made it past Sulawesi, which is in like the corner. It's basically where the Wallace line is that divides, you know, if you know, we've talked about Sundaland. It's like kind of where Sundaland kind of meets Australia down there. If you can see that map, like where mainland Australia, the top, basically the northwestern corner where it meets Indonesia there. Let's see here. Yeah, Bessie belonged to the Toleans, and again, they were hunter-gatherers. Bessie's DNA is the first ancient DNA discovered in Wallasey. So I think Wallasey, is it Wallasey or Wallasey? I don't know. But that's the area that all those chains of islands right there in the corner of Indonesia by Australia. So they found it in a cave. I think that they're saying that this is the oldest skeletal remains that they found in that area, which is kind of interesting.
Sweet.
Let's see here. Archaeologist Adam Brum from Griffith University in Australia is quoted saying, "These seafaring hunter-gatherers were the earliest inhabitants of Sahul." Sahul. I don't know how you pronounce that either. Lots of words. The supercontinent that emerged during the Pleistocene Ice Age when the global sea levels fell, exposing a land bridge between Australia and New Guinea. So again, we've talked about this a million times, the Younger Dryas era and the end of the last ice age, and how sea levels were way lower at the end of, you know, towards the end of the ice age. And then when all the ice melts, you know, all that stuff that's above sea level now fills in, and we lose probably tons of, you know, data, whether it be, you know, sites, you know, like I think we did actually last episode we did on this, the Science News one, we talked about how they're looking around using LIDAR around Australia, some of the more shallow spots for settlements and archaeological sites. So this is probably not a bad, you know, if you're looking in Doggerland, which connects, you know, Great Britain to the rest of Europe, or you're looking in Sundaland, which is this area between Indonesia and Australia. Those are probably really good places to look for artifacts and skeletons, skeletal remains, and that kind of a thing. So let's see here. Adam Brum also says, to reach Sahul, these pioneering humans made ocean crossings through Wallacea, or Wallacea, again, I don't know how you pronounce it, but little about their journey is known. The discovery of Bessie and the implications of her genetic ancestry show how little we understand about early humans, about the early human story in our region, and how much more there is left to uncover. Two previous studies have suggested that two deeply divergent Denisovan lineages admixed into ancestors of Papuan individuals, but our genomic data currently does not have enough resolution to distinguish among one or multiple introgression pulses. Lots of big words there, folks.
Oh yeah, yeah, yep.
So yeah, I think that that's kind of interesting, though. That again, there's really not a lot known about that area. I think that we'll see more and more discoveries again in the Sundaland, that whole area over there by the Wallace Line and everything, because there was a land bridge there.
Yeah, and so when the radar picks up, radar, LIDAR, all that stuff, you know, we'll be able to check out what's going on down below.
And if you listen or watch our show, you know that we're big fans of both the mainstream academic view, but also the alternative stuff like Graham Hancock and all that kind of stuff. I like to know everything so I know where the blind spots are and who's full of crap. And I think that, I mean, Graham Hancock's been pointing to that area, you know, via the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis for a while, and that's a place that we should be looking. So I mean, again, keep your eye out. So it says, among archaeologists there's a debate over whether the Tholians came, or when they came from and when they arrived in Wallacea. So Bessie shows no apparent ancestry with modern humans living in the area. So pretty interesting. And I know we've had Dr. Gregory Little on and Andrew Collins on to talk about Denisovans and their book Denisovan Origins. Again, very fascinating topic. There's not a ton of evidence yet for the whole Denisovan thing. There is more coming out, though. I know that there was even a recent article a few months ago regarding that. So we'll just keep an eye on that.
Yeah.
Okay. Neanderthal hunting camp in Madrid dated to 76,000 years ago. Professor Abel Machlin from the National Center for Research on Human Evolution, the author of the study, which is based on recent findings at the Abrigo de Navalomillo archaeological site in Madrid. The paper suggests that the Neanderthals put together hunting parties in the area, which they would hunt deers and bovids. Researchers found cut marks on the animal teeth and bones, and they were made, basically these marks were made by stone tools. They found a large bovid jaw, a hyena, giant horse teeth, and rhinoceros. Let's see here. The dating of organic matter found in the area proved that it was a temporary hunting site, and that they would then transport the meat to use. Okay, so it was a they were using it as a temporary hunting site, and then they would transport the meat and whatever all their useful parts to their more permanent settlements outside of that area. So that's kind of interesting. I mean, that's what people kind of do now, right? You go hunting in the middle of nowhere, whether it's Alaska or you know, deep in the woods, and you're gonna do all your stuff there and then trek out whatever, you know, you have that you're gonna use, basically. So
yeah, I mean, if you could go back in time to any era, where would you go?
What do you mean, like throughout history?
Yeah,
I don't know, like prehistory or during like civilization, like civilized eras.
Anything, because because when we go and we do these episodes, I always just think back. It's like I just want to go back and see what's really going on in my mind. We can concoct all kinds of things, but it's like going back and seeing the dinosaurs, and they're all feathered. You know, they look like they're these big birds flapping around. You know what I'm saying? It could be something completely different than the way that we bring up these ideas in our society. That's why it's interesting, where it's like science is right until it's wrong, kind of thing.
I mean, I would go back to like probably the time of Göbekli Tepe, because nobody understands exactly what was going on then, what those people were like. And I think it showed, that time period shows a massive shift in human consciousness from hunter-gatherer to civilized, you know, human beings. Did we domesticate ourselves, you know, or what was that process like, and why did that happen, you know?
So yeah, absolutely. I think I would always just stick with the Egyptian time, but
yeah, I mean, ancient Egypt would be fascinating too. I mean, if you go back to 3200 BC when kind of it all began, according to mainstream, it could go back further, but and again, they even found that piece of wood. That woman archaeologist found that piece of wood in that box from the Great Pyramid that dated it 100 or 1,000 years previous, or 1,000 years, you know, prior to the mainstream timeline. So
it's crazy.
I think that was last year too that they found that. Let's see here. Okay. At 3,200 square feet, it is the largest known of this type of site found in the Iberian Peninsula region, and one of only a few ever found. The researchers used AI to sort through the data. I think they used AI to figure out kind of what bones and sift through the things and figure out what they were, I think is mm-hmm. what I read. Barcelona University archaeologists discovered a 65,000-year-old abstract Neanderthal cave painting in Cueva de Ardales in Malaga, Spain. I think that was pretty recently, too. I didn't want to throw that whole article in here, but yeah, you can find that one as well. So this one's kind of interesting. The Lore Lindu, I believe that's how you pronounce it, National Park megaliths. The Lore Lindu megaliths are very mysterious, and it is unknown who carved the Bata Valley megalith statue, which you see there pictured on the left, and that was discovered in 1908. Sulawesi is east of the Wallace Line. That's what I was talking about earlier with that other site, and one of the four greater Sunda Islands. It was first inhabited when the island was part of the land bridge used for the settlement of Australia and New Guinea, at least around, I think, 40,000 BC. Most of the current island inhabitants descended from the Bouguenese or Bugis people, which migrated there 2500 BC. Not a lot is known about the Bugis? I don't know how you pronounce that. People in regards to the archaeological research, but anthropologists theorize that there was a chieftain-based culture which revolved around hunting and gathering, and, you know, basically shifting agriculture. Because I think I read in there too, there was like a lot of droughts in that area too, so it was always moving around.
Yeah.
There are over 400 megalithic monuments found in the Bata Valley around the park, or Bata, that's probably how you pronounce it. The Arca just means stone, I think, in that language. Menhirs have large heads and a single line to define the facial features. The stone statues have long straight bodies that are found alone in pairs or in small groups. Let's see here. Some people date them as far back as 5,000 years ago. But I think that that's like the furthest back that some people, 5,000 is like the furthest I've seen people talk about this. It could be, you know, even further back, but that's just what I've seen. But there's little evidence I found to support that. Some researchers have found similarities to the megalithic culture found, Laos and Cambodia. That culture, but I think most academics have dated this to sometime between 750 and 1300 AD. So, again, it's weird when you see some of this stuff, and it's like, it looks like it could be a lot older. I mean, look at this one in particular. It looks like kind of like the Easter Island. Or Göbekli Tepe with the hands around the navel area. So that's kind of interesting. But it just really depends when you're doing like the dating stuff, because even like Easter Island, which they don't even know how or where the basalt quarry is, where some of the oldest moai were carved from the basalt. I think we talked about that before too, and like Jacques Cousteau may have found a basalt quarry off the coast of the island, and I know Robert Schock has pointed to the fact that that would have pushed the dating back to when the sea level was a lot lower. So I mean, it's kind of interesting.
Absolutely.
So for sure, you would go back to ancient Egypt then, huh?
Because
I thought when you said that you were going to say that you wanted to go back to like when there was Neanderthals or Denisovans.
Well, that would be an interesting time too, but there's so much mystery around the pyramids, and you would be, I'll bring it back to the fame. You'd be so recognized if you had the real information, although who's going to believe you anyway, but I think that's the biggest mystery of our time, the pyramids, don't you? It's something that still's there. And
yeah, I mean I would say it is, in the sense that I think that's the one that most people can relate to, because it's like, here's this culture fascinated with death, and they had specific burial processes where they would make these mummies, and then the mummification process, and they're fascinated with death and consciousness. And
Göbekli Tepe is cool too, because people think that they were just hunter gatherers, or they were supposed to be just that.
Right.
And they were able to create something that exquisite. So that would be a cool one too.
Well,
again, anything would be. The dinosaurs would be cool too, but I don't know. There's not people around. So, and also when you're talking about Neanderthals and stuff like that, I would think that the Egyptian time, I think they would be educated enough where we could kind of communicate, but the Neanderthal, they might see you as a threat and attack. I don't know. Egyptian times might as well, but I would think that they would be a little bit more. I would like to converse with the people too. The time of the forming of America and stuff like that, and like, talking to Einstein, that would be cool too, but I don't know. The Egyptian thing, especially with our family, how we have some kind of connection with our uncle and grandfathers, we've always been kind of connected to the Egypt time frame. So
Yeah, I mean, again, I like the Göbekli Tepe one for sure, because like I said, I think it symbolizes a shift in obviously civilization and consciousness, and you even see like beer making possible rituals, maybe even involving entheogens, So I think that there's definitely a shift there. I had a kind of like an epiphany too, and we'll probably do an episode about it at some point, but it's just like, do you know how long it takes throughout history to have one of those shifts? Like you would see at Göbekli Tepe. And that's, by the way, I would point out, that's assuming that that's the oldest, or I know Karahan Tepe's pretty close to there, which they think is probably a little bit older, and there's some other sites that they've been finding in that area. But let's just assume that's the one, right? That's the first one symbolizing civilization. Then I would point to the fact that, like, I don't know, that might be one of the largest consciousness shifts in modern human history in terms, I mean, we've been around for what, between 200 and 300,000 years as modern human beings. That might be the single defining moment, like us, if we did domesticate ourselves doing so.
Yeah, and I just want to point out the fact that if you're enjoying tonight's episode, smash that like button.
And that's why we have them here, folks. fascinating stuff for sure. And I don't know much about this site either, but I want to look into it more for sure. Like I said, men here and the heads and the statues are pretty fascinating. So,
and I'll keep working on that time machine, and maybe in the next couple of years we can go on an adventure.
Yeah, we'll send our correspondent Maurice out to the.
I'm here at ancient times.
So here's just a map that circled the red circles around the area. Actually, two of our articles. That's the one that we discussed with the 7,200-year-old. Indonesian woman's skeleton that was found in the cave, and then also the one we just talked about, the Bata Valley one. So, I mean, that area is pretty interesting because obviously there's a plate, you know, separation there, and then also what happened with the land bridge at the end of the last ice age and all that stuff. So. Again, check out Sundaland if you find that fascinating. Okay. So whenever you talk about Mount Vesuvius, I think most people identify with Pompeii and, you know, these people being preserved in ash and everything. Mm-hmm. But most people don't realize that there was a city called Herculaneum that was also destroyed. So bones found at Herculaneum reveal diet before Mount Vesuvius eruption. So in 79 AD, Mount Vesuvius erupted, killing the people of Pompeii, but a lot of people, again, that was just what I said, the people were killed at Herculaneum. They were also destroyed by the pyroclastic flows from the volcano. New research looked at isotopes in the bone collagen of 17 people's remains from Herculaneum and found that the men ate more seafood than the women. Of the 17 remains, 11 were men and 6 were women. Carbon and nitrogen isotopes in the amino acids in the remains show that men had 50% more protein from seafood. The study shows females also got a majority of their protein from animals, fruits, and vegetables. Let's see here.
What does that mean?
So men were eating seafood. They were eating fish and probably, I mean, a bunch of stuff. I mean, I don't know what else is in there. Probably like octopus.
Right, but what is that alluding to? Is it just a fact, or is there something?
So this would point to that it was either a combination of men were obviously fishing and doing that kind of stuff. So that's probably what they were eating. But it's also like a status thing. And if you had money, which I'm sure more men took care of themselves back then and could care less, it sounds like, that's what was going on there. And it says archaeologists at the University of York and author of the paper, Sylvia Sonson, said it was previously known that men of Herculaneum had more access to fish via fishing and status, but it was unclear of whether this was just Herculaneum or if it applied to like the Roman diet in general. So they don't know if this is just how it was in the area or if this was just specific to like the that area. But yeah, I mean, again, you know, is it a luxury? I'm sure.
Absolutely.
Back then, it for sure was. So.
I love me some seafood.
I know you love Joe Stonecrab.
Yeah, me and your wife have a connection to the favorite restaurant.
My wife loves it too. It's her favorite food. I mean, I love Joe Stonecrab too. It's just such
It's very particular. It's very. Like
stone crab, though, you get. I mean, it's interesting because they just take the claws off and like they throw them back, and like the crab grows them back. But
it's as humane as you're gonna get to the crab to killing the crab because they don't die. I don't know about chopping their arm off, but they're right. not fully dying.
But
so.
I feel like even the colossals or the jumbos, you're still not getting like a ton of meat out of that. I don't know. But
well, the last time we went, I took my mom. She got lobster and she did not like her dish. I was like, you got to get what they're known for. Why are you going off the menu? You go there, you get one item, and that's it. It's the stone
crab. I told
you,
I think they're also known for their fried chicken, believe it or
yeah,
not.
Yeah, I know. I've seen it. The last time, every time I go there, I always see people with a big pile of chicken on there. It's a very interesting
you should get it next time.
Separation. I might have, I don't know if I'm going to go again because my girlfriend's allergic to shellfish, so it's like kind of pointless to go to a stone crab place when one of us can't even eat it.
Right. Well, I mean, you got to do what you got to do. All right. Yeah. Okay, so this is a recent find as well. Russian archaeologists uncover Amber Man tomb from the Copper Age. So archaeologists from Petrozavodsk State University in Russia have discovered the burial site of a man dubbed Amber Man. He was painted with ochre, which is like a reddish, clayish colored dye. On his deathbed and buried with more than 100 pieces of jewelry. Archaeologist Alexander Zulnikov, I believe that's how you pronounce his name, led a team of students on a dig to the western shore of Lake Onega, which is the second largest lake in Europe, which is in Russia. The students found the unique burial site surrounded by amber jewelry and flint objects. Inside, the man was painted with ochre, again, which is a red pigment often found to mark graves. It was surrounded by 140 pieces of amber jewelry from the Baltic region. The man was most likely of high social standing and was possibly a trader. Burials with so many jewels were previously unheard of in this area of Karelia, nor have they been uncovered in nearby northwestern regions. Let's see here. In ancient northern Europe, valuable objects like jewelry and tools helped maintain social hierarchies. So obviously this was a person of status, and it's kind of interesting. I mean, I think the Copper Age goes from like 1600 BC to like 3200 BC, if I'm not mistaken. I'd have to look that up, but yeah, pretty interesting stuff. Okay, so this one's right up our alley. The Eleusis Plutonian, you know, it's a sacred site, a sacred sanctuary connected to the Eleusinian mysteries. The cave is in Eleusis, which is located in the, I don't even know, Thriasian Plain, I don't even know how you pronounce that, in West Attica, Greece. It was built in the 6th century BC at the northeast base of the Acropolis, where two caves are naturally formed into the rock face. The site is famous for being associated with the Eleusinian mysteries and the cults of Demeter and Persephone. Persephone, or Kor, who is the daughter of Zeus and Demeter, was abducted and taken to the underworld by Hades, who's also known as Plato in the Roman god pantheon. Persephone then became the queen of the underworld, but she would return to the surface every spring. Persephone had to spend a third of the year in the underworld with Hades after eating some of the pomegranate seeds. Persephone was basically the personification of the agricultural cycle. Her central myth served as context for the sacred rites and regeneration, along with the rites known as the Aporeta, or the Unrepeatables, which were performed in the Telesterion. And the Telesterion is actually, when we started the podcast, that was my background, was the Telesterion.
Yeah.
Demeter, you know, out of anger, made the earth barren, which became winter every year, until she saw Persephone, and then spring would reemerge and everything would regrow. Let's see here. So we've talked about this many times. This myth is actually kind of like an archetype. Well, first of all, we know now that the Eleusinian mysteries are associated with some sort of psychedelic ritual or entheogenic ritual, which they would ingest something And then they would go into the Telesterion and experience something. And it was like this whole process. They would like fast days leading up to it. And the Lesser Mysteries were performed every year and anybody could go to that. But the Greater Mysteries, you could only go once in your entire life. So, And the Greater Mysteries is when you would experience this entheogenic experience. And basically you would, it would transform your the way you think about things. And I would assume that when I show you these caves, that maybe even these caves are responsible for or inspiring Plato, for, you know, Plato's allegory of the cave, or obviously, you know, they used it in context with this myth of being taken into the underworld, or Persephone being taken into the underworld by Hades. And so there's two caves. The smaller cave contains an opening with a rock stairway that leads outside the Plutonian enclosure to a deep pit, and it was associated with the cult rituals of the Eleusinian Mysteries. The larger of the two caves was held a 4th century BC rectangular temple. It was called a cella or a cella, and it replaced the earlier structure from the 6th century BC in dedication to Pluto. Reliefs were found nearby and are related to Pluto and Persephone, who would descend and ascend into the underworld every year. So another thing is this is an example of basically, it's like a shamanic archetype. I mean, I can equate this to some of the myths, you know, found in the Amazon, or the mythology from the Amazon, mythology of Osiris being taken apart in the underworld and then being pieced back together. You know, a lot of these mythologies from around the world are associated with being taken to the underworld and then either being brought back to life or being re-put together, kind of a thing. And This is no different. I think that this is definitely, obviously, they found physical evidence of entheogens in some of the pottery and chalices and stuff. So, yeah, I think it's pretty interesting. So we're going to do a whole episode on that. I've been holding off for a while, but we kind of put our ancient Greece series on the back burner with a lot of stuff going on, but we'll bring it back. I have some slideshow episodes ready to go for that. So
nice.
But yeah, interesting stuff. So here's a couple pictures of those caves. Here's the first one. And it's kind of an interesting place. Obviously the cave part looks obviously natural, but then they built structures around it. And again, I mean, you got to think Plato experiencing the Eleusinian Mysteries in an altered state. Is that where he got the inspiration for the allegory of the cave, you know, or
it's possible. It's definitely, you know, possible.
So, I mean, I think about that kind of stuff all the time. Obviously it's all about paradigm shifts and everything. And if you would think that if he was experiencing that, he would have experienced a paradigm shift. So. Okay. So this article is flower bouquets used in rituals found in the tunnel beneath Teotihuacan pyramid. Archaeologists recently discovered 4 flower bouquets dating to around 1800 years ago in the pre-Hispanic city of Teotihuacan, which is near modern day Mexico City. I think it's like northeast or something of Mexico City. They were discovered in a tunnel beneath the pyramid dedicated to Quetzalcoatl, who is the plumed serpent god. So anybody that watches our show pretty regularly, I suggest if you're interested in this, you go back and watch our episode with Tom Lane. Where we go into Mesoamerican metaphysics in association with the psilocybin psychedelic mushroom rituals. And they have mushroom codices, which, you know, it's probably one of the only for sure slam dunk evidence of entheogenic use in ancient world, especially the Americas. I mean, obviously we just talked about the Eleusinian Mysteries and all that, but they're, you know, they had to do a deep dive to find all that stuff. But this stuff's just right out in the open pretty much. But Tom Lane does a great job of, you know, describing the metaphysics and Quetzalcoatl, and Quetzalcoatl is the god that you meet when you go through these rituals, and towards the end, this is the entity that you meet. So, he said it's like meeting, and he's met Quetzalcoatl a bunch of times, but what's the one I was going to say, we can go back to the history of it, but I mean, I think Quetzalcoatl is like an evolution of, you know, Viracocha, Contiki Viracocha, you know, it goes all the way back to the Incan gods as well. So, yeah, Tom Lane does an amazing job of describing all that. And go check out his book too, Sacred Mushroom Rituals, The Search for the Blood of Quetzalcoatl. So if you haven't checked that out, go check that out. It's definitely worth a read. It's about his adventures into Mexico, and he does these sacred mushroom rituals with Maria Sabina, who's a famous Sabia, which is basically somebody who facilitates these sacred mushroom rituals. So,
yeah, Tom Lane is Mind Escape episode 74. That's the sacred mushroom rituals part one, and then I think we do four parts on that. So if you guys are interested, go back and check those out. They're unbelievable. Some of my favorite episodes, because it's not only is it very good information, but he's visual aids, and you can really see the what's going on there.
Yeah, he actually really pulls up some of the actual pages and codices and everything. So we go through all that, which is pretty cool. Let's see here. Again, they find this tunnel beneath the pyramid. It says the research team plans to determine what kind of flowers are represented and when they were collected. I also want to point out, too, that even in, I think it's Magicians of the Gods, I think it's Graham Hancock talking about how this archetype of like Viracocha and Quetzalcoatl, and it's kind of all the same kind of archetype, and how it's this civilization bringer, and instead of sacrificing people, Quetzalcoatl teaches them to sacrifice flowers. So this is kind of interesting in context with that. Is that what's going on here? Is that part of that ritual? I don't know, but pretty interesting stuff. Sergio Gomez Chavez, who is the director of the Tlalocan, I believe that's how you pronounce it, project, said in total there are four bouquets of flowers in very good condition. They're still tied with ropes, probably cotton. This is very important because the find, it speaks to the rituals, and they were carried out in this place. Let's see. Okay, so it says the bouquets contain somewhere between 40 and 60 flowers, and they were part of a ceremony involving a large bonfire. Oh, this is kind of interesting. The tunnel that runs below the pyramid extended further than archaeologists originally thought, and even contained a sculpture of the rain and fertility god Taloc. The secret tunnel that was discovered in 2003 after a rainstorm revealed a sinkhole near the temple. Researchers found thousands of artifacts at the site so far. Some of the finds include obsidian, cocoa beans, and animal remains. The team also discovered a mini landscape with tiny mountains and lakes made of liquid mercury. The secret tunnel walls were decorated with fool's gold, which reflected light to create the illusion of the sky with stars. So that sounds amazing. I mean,
sweet,
I want to.
Yeah.
Sounds like a little great landscape one down there. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, it's definitely interesting stuff for sure. Let's see here. So there's a picture of Teotihuacan, and then you have the Pyramid of the Moon, Pyramid of the Sun. And yeah, it's just interesting stuff. We haven't really done a ton on this actual site for the podcast, but I'm sure we'll get around to it. There's just so many different sites and eras and civilizations that we want to cover. It's just too much. Not enough time in the day.
No.
Okay, so this one hits close to home. We are both from Michigan, we've traveled pretty much all over the state. Been to the west side of the state, been in the northern part of the main part of Michigan. We've both been to the UP camping and stuff. So this article says, Michigan farm field find rewrites archaeological history. Archaeologists unearthed campsites set up for or set up 13,000 years ago by the Clovis people. If you're not familiar with the Clovis people, they're supposedly the first people that inhabited North America. However, I don't know why they don't talk about this in the article, but that's supposedly not the case anymore. I mean, I can tell you that I've even found recent articles, like there's a cave in Chiquihite, Mexico, where they found stone tools and arrowheads that date back to, I think, 30,000 years ago. So even that alone would debunk the whole Clovis first idea, which was that the Clovis people were the first people here, like roughly, you know, 16,000, 15,000 years ago.
Yeah, you know, I'm pretty bummed. Like I was saying earlier, this whole summer has been just flying by, and I never really got to go on too many adventures.
Really?
Well, not just...
I mean, yeah, for like our podcast, adventures. You mean. I was going to say, you have done some stuff, though. But yeah, we'll...
Right.
I mean, maybe when it cools down a little bit, we can get you out there and do something.
Yeah, I need to go on. I need to find the tools. I need to...
Well, actually, the guy that, I'm going to get to this at the bottom, but the guy that found the initial Clovis point, I think, was an amateur. He was just going through a field and found it and then notified U of M, and then they came in and did their thing. But
yeah.
Okay, so it says it's the oldest known sign of humans in the Michigan Basin. The Clovis used to be known as I mentioned, because I know that they found other sites that predate Clovis people. And even when we've had Dr. Gregory Little on, there's quite a few sites in South America, at least, that are pretty old, a lot older than what they're saying here. Let's see here. The site was occupied by a small group of people from about six or seven who briefly lived on a river in southwest Michigan towards the end of the Pleistocene. Okay, so this site is actually, if you look at that map of lower Michigan, all the way to the bottom left, and then in three, where it says St. Joseph's County, that's where that find was made. I think it's called the Belson site where it was found. Let's see here. The Clovis people were a Paleo-Indian culture who lived in the Americas between 13,000 and 12,500 years ago. They are identified by their distinctive spear points. Most Native Americans today can trace their ancestry back to these early inhabitants, according to Brendan Nash, who is a U of M doctoral student and author of the paper. Nash said, as the glaciers were retreating, they created a predictable ice front environment that was frequented by early humans' favorite prey, and the early humans had a wolf model of subsistence. They traveled around in large groups and didn't stay in any place too long. They were an apex predator and probably doing both hunting and scavenging, perhaps by running other Ice Age predators such as saber-toothed tigers and short-faced bears off with their prey. Well, let's see here. What we have at the Belson site appears to be a short-term camp by a group that would likely split off the main group seasonally. And again, this is the guy I was talking about. So Thomas Talbot is a researcher who found the Clovis spear point in 2008. He found it in a farm in early spring of that year. So he was just like an amateur dude, just walking through the farm and found it and then notified U of M.
Yeah, it could be me.
Sending our correspondent out in the field.
Take us to the map, baby.
You know, and I would just think back to, like, we grew up in Michigan. I remember, like, digging in our backyards for, like, bugs and stuff when we were younger and finding, like, arrowheads and stuff. I mean, when you're younger, you don't even really think about it. But now that I'm older.
I remember digging and finding some pieces of building. And then we're like, this is from an ancient church. And then we make up all kinds of stories. But maybe we were always just natural storytellers.
Yeah, maybe. But I, you know, obviously this one is interesting because it's, again, what we talk about with the end of the Younger Dryas, you know, possibly correlated to the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis and all this stuff, you know, Randall Carlson and Graham Hancock and all those guys. So,
yeah.
But yeah, it's just interesting because you do think of Michigan being under like a huge wall of ice at that time. You don't really think about that. However, I will point out on the first version of this that we did, Science News 1, we talk about that site in Lake Huron or the Huron Straits that they found, think they found like a Stonehenge underwater that's pretty old. And then they also, there's underwater Stonehenge site in Traverse Bay, Michigan, that also might have like an etched woolly mammoth or mastodon into the side of it. So we've talked about those as well. Interesting stuff. I mean,
absolutely. I like doing these.
Okay. So this one, the magnetic field records from 9,000 years ago teach us about the magnetic field today. Researchers from three different universities discovered data regarding the magnetic field that prevailed in the Middle East between 10,000 and 8,000 years ago. The researchers studied pottery and burnt flints from archaeological sites in Jordan, which recorded the magnetic field during that time period. Data on the magnetic field from the prehistoric times can help us understand the magnetic field of today. Professor Ben Yosef was quoted saying, Albert Einstein characterized the planet's magnetic field as one of five greatest mysteries of modern physics. As of now, we know a number of basic facts about it. The magnetic field generated by processes that takes place below the depth of approximately 3,000 kilometers beneath the surface of the planet. For the sake of comparison, the deepest human drilling depth is only about 20 kilometers. I think that's that Kola site in Siberia or that Russian site. That's the deepest they've gotten, I think. I don't know. It protects the planet from continuing bombardment of cosmic radiation, thus allows life as we know it to exist. It is volatile, and it is its strength and direction constantly shifting. It is connected to the various phenomena in the atmosphere and the planet's ecological system, including possibly having a certain impact on climate. Nevertheless, the magnetic field's essence and origins have remained largely unresolved. In our research, we sought to open a peephole into the great riddle. So that's kind of interesting.
Absolutely.
That
picture's sweet too.
Yeah. We have only had the instruments and technology to record the Earth's magnetic field for the last 200 years. So that's really not that long. Let's see here. The magnetic information remains frozen forever until another heating event. Within tiny crystals of the ferromagnetic minerals from which can be extracted using a series of experiments in the magnetics laboratory. Let's see here. Sometime during the Neolithic period, the field became very weak. It was the weakest values ever recorded for the last 10,000 years. It then recovered and strengthened within a relatively short amount of time. According to Professor Lisa Tox, I think that's how you pronounce it, in our time, since measurements began less than 200 years ago, we have seen a continuous decrease in the field's strength. So that's pretty interesting as well. Yeah, so that's all I got there.
Good. A couple of good juicy tidbits for you.
We're going to get a shirt made with this kid's face. It just says juicy tidbits underneath it.
It makes Michael nervous of what's coming out of my mouth next.
He's just a real wild card, folks.
Yeah, except I'm very restrained.
No, interesting stuff. And we'll do more of these too. We were doing them before, but it's just so hard to, you know, life happens and things. We get guests all the time too, so it's hard to balance all this stuff out. But I know Sandy, Sandy's been asking for them, so that's why I thought we would do one.
Yeah, they're very nice when we don't have a guest that week. We can kind of go into what's going on in the world and stuff like that. And yeah. I'm going to start writing stuff. Stuff pops up, especially about space exploration and things like that, that it always pops up. I have a little app that has a bunch of different news and stuff like that. A lot of it's geared towards filming and camera gear, but there's always some cool science stuff that pops up. I'll have to write it down next time.
Nice. Yeah, I mean, we can do those too. I think we did a physics one or a space and physics one before. We did a psychedelic research one before. I mean, we can, like I said, we can do these. There's never a shortage amount of new articles coming out regarding all this stuff. So
no, especially with the UAP and stuff like that. I'm surprised we didn't have anything in there this time, but
right,
it's building.
Yeah, should be interesting stuff going forward, and we do have some good guests coming up as well, so stay tuned for that. And yeah, onward and upward, and we'll just keep chipping away here.
Yes, sir.
And if anybody is interested too in like these kind of episodes or even different ones, just leave a comment or a message or send us an email. And, you know, we're always open to suggestions. Obviously, if it doesn't fit with our show, you know, we're not going to do it. But if it's something that we already are kind of doing, I definitely consider it. And I have done episodes for people in the past, especially top escapee, Sandy. This one tonight was one of her requests. So we love
Absolutely.
You, Sandy.
We always encourage a nice dialogue between us and our fans. And if you guys can think of anything or would like to comment, for sure leave it down below. Hit that thumbs up, though, because that kind of stuff helps us with the algorithms. We're always trying to manipulate them.
That goes for guests, too. If we have a guest, you know, that you want us to have on, we're more than willing to give it a whirl with that as well. Shout out to John. Thank you so much. That was very nice of you, and we appreciate that. We appreciate you tuning in as well. And that's it. Before we head on out of here, everyone head over to Patreon at patreon.com/mindescapepodcast. For just $2 a month, you'll get exclusive guest episodes and segments. Tons of stuff on there. You know, if you like this and you like all the ancient stuff we do, I think we've got segments. We've got a whole bunch of them from, you know, ancient civilization stuff. And I think there's one with Randall Carlson where he gives a sacred geometry, you know, a little lesson there. So go check that out. And head on over to IndrusWeb.org. This is a social media platform we created to connect open minds. So if you like all the stuff that we talk about on the show, head on over there, set up a profile, and start discussing. And yeah, that's it. Like I said, we've got a bunch of great guests coming up, and there'll be more ancient civilization stuff too. And I do want to get Laura back on to discuss part two of that ancient Malta thing that we were
doing.
Oh
yeah, she was very good. I liked her.
She's awesome. So if you haven't checked her out already, go check out her page on YouTube, Megalith Hunter. So And she's got an awesome Instagram channel too. So she puts her videos and pictures, and she lives on Malta too. So it's not like she just kind of knows about it or
she's very close to the action.
Researches it. She goes hiking and goes to all these sites and takes awesome pictures. So go check out Laura's channel again. That's Megalith Hunter. And yeah, we'll have her back on as well. So, all right. Well, we love everybody. Stay safe out there, and we'll catch you next time. Peace.
Peace.